This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
The Holocaust stands out as one of the most horrific acts of genocide ever carried out by mankind.
Against the bloody backdrop of the Second World War, Nazi Germany engaged in an unconscionable campaign of captivity, torture, and murder against millions of Jewish people.
The Nazis' reign of terror brought Europe to its knees in the 1930s and 40s, but even in the heart of Germany, there was resistance. Ordinary men and women fought against tyranny right under its nose and became heroes.
One such man was Oskar Schindler, a failed businessman, philanderer, and general ne'er-do-well who became a spy for the Nazis before turning against them.
Schindler was a German industrialist and an unlikely hero who used his business acumen and his ties to the Nazi Party to save the lives of nearly 1,200 Jewish prisoners, an act of heroism for which he is still revered to this day.
Hi, I'm Vanessa Richardson.
And I'm Carter Roy. Welcome to Historical Figures on the Parcast Network. Every other Wednesday, we discuss a different person's lasting historical impact, unique personality, and impression on the world around them.
Our audio biographies cover big lives, but we like to focus on little-known facts. Today we're discussing Oskar Schindler, a businessman and Nazi spy who used his money and connections to save over 1,000 Jewish lives from the death camps of Poland during World War II.
If you want to listen to any previous episodes, you can find them and all of Parcast shows on your favorite podcast directory.
A lot of you ask how to help the show. Well, if you enjoy the podcast, the best way to help us is to leave us a 5-star review.
Now, back to the life of Oskar Schindler. Oskar Schindler was born on April 28, 1908, the first child of Johann Hans Schindler, a factory owner, and Franziska Schindler. He had one sister, Elfriede, who was 7 years younger. Despite the age difference, Oskar and Elfriede were close.
Though he was not a particularly gifted student, Oskar was well-liked by his schoolmates. He had several friends, including the two sons of a local Jewish rabbi.
The Schindlers lived in Svitavy, a town in what was once part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and is now part of the Czech Republic. Oskar's ancestors hailed from Vienna, and he grew up culturally Austrian-German.
When the Austro-Hungarian Empire broke apart after World War I, the region where the Schindlers lived, called the Sudetenland, became part of the new nation of Czechoslovakia. This new country was a mishmash of distant ethnic groups, including Germans, Czechs, Slovaks, Hungarians, Poles, and Ruthenians.
The turn of the 20th century was a politically turbulent time in Europe, and the various groups that made up Czechoslovakia were separated by language barriers, ethnicity, and customs. These groups tended to isolate themselves so as to preserve their own cultures. Thus, even though Oskar grew up around people of different nationalities, he was raised to identify as a German.
Oskar's early life wasn't easy. His father, Hans, was a violent alcoholic who often had affairs. His home life wasn't very stable. Oskar performed poorly in school and would often get into trouble.
As a teenager in 1924, Oskar was expelled for forging his report card, an act which earned him the nickname Schindler the Crook. It's a moniker he would come to embody more and more as he grew up.
Though he did eventually graduate secondary school, Schindler never applied to college. Instead, he went to a number of trade schools, bouncing from one potential career to another. He tried machinery and chauffeuring and learned to repair heaters, but abandoned each path early on.
In the fall of 1927, 19-year-old Oscar accompanied his father on a sales trip to a neighboring farm. Oscar met the farmer's daughter, Amelia Peltzel, and was smitten.
He visited her several more times over the next few months and eventually asked for her hand. Amelia and Oscar married in Svitavy on March 6, 1928. Oscar was 20 years old.
They lived with Oscar's parents for the first few years of their marriage, which put a strain on their relationship. Amelia didn't care for Oscar's drunk of a father.
Oscar himself was little help, as he was often away on business trips or pursuing his own interests. He became enamored with fast cars and motorcycle racing, and even came third in a 1928 cross-country motorcycle race. Oscar had dreams of being a professional racer, but he was never quite fast enough to make that dream a reality.
His other hobbies held him back on that front. As an adult, Oscar followed in his father's footsteps. He had affairs and drank. He was even arrested a number of times for drunk and disorderly conduct in the early 1930s.
In 1931, Oscar traveled to Berlin to look for work. It was there that he was first exposed to the growing radicalism of post-World War I Germany.
The job search proved fruitless, and Oscar returned to Czechoslovakia in 1932. However, it wouldn't be long before Germany followed him back to his home country.
Germany was laying the groundwork for its eventual invasion of Czechoslovakia by promoting Nazi-friendly Czech politicians.
Throughout the 1920s, the Czechoslovakian government had attempted to combat social injustices and economic inequalities by taxing the wealthy Sudetenland Germans. This seeded resentment among the Czech-German population.
This, in turn, led to the rise of German nationalist politicians like Konrad Henlein, who formed the Sudetenland German Party, or SDP. The SDP was pro-Nazi and actively advocated for the dissolution of Czechoslovakia and the annexation of the Sudetenland by Germany.
The German counterintelligence and counter-espionage organization, Abwehr, began operating in Czechoslovakia in the mid-1930s, recruiting agents from within the German Czech population to promote German interests.
Oskar Schindler joined the SDP in 1935, falling in line with many of his fellow Czech Germans. Sensing an opportunity, Oskar joined the Abwehr soon after.
Schindler saw the Abwehr as a chance to meet prominent, powerful people and maybe raise his own status from that of a failed businessman. He didn't mind that the price for this networking would be working for the Nazis.
Later in life, Schindler would downplay his involvement with the Abwehr due to the post-war stigma against those who had cooperated with the Nazis. But testimony from those who knew his work shows he was a competent and savvy spy.
A report from the Czech secret police described Schindler as a, quote, spy of big caliber and an especially dangerous type, end quote. This is in line with what we know of Schindler's character. Though his personal flaws, his alcoholism and hedonistic nature had held him back, Oscar was a born salesman. He was charming and friendly and skilled at getting people to trust him. Most importantly, Schindler wasn't blinded by ideology. He was interested primarily in his own self-interest. All of these traits made him a particularly adept spy.
Dr. Sobotka, a Czech policeman who interviewed Oscar after the war, concluded that Schindler was attracted to the Abwehr not by the Nazi ideals, but by his natural hedonism.
Sobotka described Oscar as, quote, a very frivolous man of shady character whose only aspiration was to obtain easily and without work a lot of money, end quote.
During his time with the Abwehr, Schindler learned a lot about the inner workings of the Nazi Party and its bureaucracy. He made contacts with officials and other spies. He had no way of knowing at the time, but these contacts would one day prove vital to Schindler's mission to rescue Jews from the Nazi death camps.
Schindler was primarily charged with collecting information on troop movements and railway operations, and with recruiting more spies to the Abwehr.
To that end, he joined the Czechoslovakian army in order to further embed himself. By 1938, he had become a lance corporal in the reserves, all the while funneling information back to his Nazi comrades.
Germany invaded Austria in 1938. Oscar later learned that following the invasion, the Germans had shut down the Austrian magazine of his uncle, Adolf Lusser. Adolf died shortly after, grief-stricken over the loss of his life's work.
This may have been the first time Oscar was personally affected by the growing Nazi threat. However, the ensuing German invasion would inadvertently save Oscar's life.
Oscar was outed as an Abwehr spy in 1938. The Czech military had long suspected him of working for the Nazis, and officers finally managed to locate incriminating documents in Schindler's apartment after he was betrayed by a friend.
Oscar was imprisoned for espionage and sentenced to death. However, before his sentence could be carried out, the Munich Agreement annexed Czechoslovakia to Germany.
The Munich Agreement was an accord signed by Britain, France, and Italy that allowed Germany to take over the Sudetenland region of Czechoslovakia. It was a desperate and ultimately failed attempt to avoid a Second World War, and it permitted Hitler to march into Czechoslovakia virtually unopposed.
Naturally, once they took over Czechoslovakia, the Nazis pardoned Schindler and sent him back to work for the Abwehr.
Though Schindler was a known spy in Czechoslovakia, his network extended outside the country, and he could continue to spy in Germany and Austria. As a thank you for preventing his execution, and as a show of loyalty, Schindler officially joined the Nazi Party in 1939.
In September of that year, Schindler and Amelia moved to Krakow, Poland, where he resumed his espionage activities under the pseudonym Otto Zieler. He gathered information and Polish military uniforms for German operatives to use, mostly through bribes and threats.
He lived dangerously, and he indulged liberally. Oscar's love of drinks and loose women only grew as he found more and more success as a spy. He even convinced his Abwehr handlers to buy him a Horsch, a very expensive road car, in order to sell his cover as a successful businessman.
Schindler would later use that very same car to escape from Soviet troops at the end of the Second World War.
Next, we'll cover Schindler's rise from undercover spy to wealthy member of the Nazi elite.
Now, back to the story. Oskar Schindler was an ethnic German raised in Czechoslovakia who began spying for the Reich in return for status and money. After his 1938 arrest in Czechoslovakia, Schindler and his wife, Emilia, moved to Poland.
Shortly after Schindler moved to Krakow, Germany invaded and conquered Poland. Schindler remained in Krakow for the duration of the war, and it was from that city that he orchestrated the rescue of over 1,000 Jews.
Emilia Schindler later said that Oscar, quote, fell in love with the bustling life and beauty of the city and did not want to leave. He was more faithful to it than to many of his women, certainly more than to me, end quote.
Schindler immersed himself in the Krakow black market and made friends with several officers in the Nazi Gestapo. He took advantage of his connections and the political turmoil to restart his career in business.
When Germany conquered Poland, it seized the property of the country's Jewish population. Schindler bribed a number of Nazi officials to allow him to cheaply purchase an enamelware factory, which he opened and operated shortly after the invasion. His initial workforce was small and included 7 Jewish Poles.
Krakow's Jewish residents had suffered immensely under the Nazi occupation. Not only had their land and valuables been seized, the Nazis had also ejected the Jewish citizens from their homes and relocated them to ghettos.
One of the ghettos was close to Schindler's new factory. Oscar saw an opportunity. Many of these people were desperate for work and would do just about anything for cheap.
A few formerly upper-class Jewish citizens invested in Schindler's business in exchange for jobs on the factory floor. Schindler was happy to take their money, and the investors were afforded the relative safety of a factory job outside of the ghetto.
Krakow's Jewish population was only allowed to leave the ghetto for work, and so a job at Schindler's factory became a coveted position. Schindler hired more and more Jewish workers. Due to the low cost of labor, he could rapidly expand his workforce, which, in turn, generated a lot of revenue. He could then take his earnings and hire more Jewish workers.
Schindler wasn't yet sympathetic to the plight of his employees, but he also wasn't cruel, as many of the other Nazis were. Word quickly spread among the ghettos that Schindler's factory was a safe place to work.
At first, Schindler did not interact much with his staff, aside from Itzhak Stern, an accountant who worked in the factory offices.
However, Oscar did take interest in the well-being of his workers, if only from the mindset that a healthy worker was more effective than a sick one.
Those who worked closely with Schindler saw the two opposing sides of him, the man who hired displaced Jewish citizens and treated them better than any other factory owner in town, and also the Nazi spy who regularly entertained Gestapo officers.
Schindler bribed these men in order to obtain permits to expand his factory further. He even began manufacturing ammunition and other supplies for the war effort.
This expansion also allowed him to justify the hiring of hundreds more workers from the ghettos. More cheap labor meant more profits for him, after all, and more profits meant larger bribes to his Nazi friends.
What the Nazis did not know, however, was that Schindler wasn't only hiring able-bodied men. As his factory expanded and he became wealthier, Schindler would hire the friends and relatives of his workers, effectively rescuing whole families from the ghettos.
At first, Schindler had hired from the ghettos simply because the people there were a cheaper and more desperate workforce than non-Jewish Poles. They were paid next to nothing, but they would do anything to keep the jobs that kept them out of the work camps every day.
As time went on, Itzhak Stern and others who had grown close to Schindler began to make requests, asking for jobs for their friends and families so that they too could escape the camps. As Oscar became more aware of what the Nazis intended for all of Europe's Jewish population, he began to agree to these requests.
Schindler's former secretary, Elizabeth Taunt, later described how she asked Schindler to save her former landlady from a terrible camp where prisoners were being killed every day. Schindler gave the landlady and her husband jobs outside the camp.
Taunt said, "When I called him, it was, quote, 2 years since I had worked for him and asked him for this favor. Shortly thereafter, I get another call from my landlady. She was now in Schindler's factory," end quote.
He altered the records of those he hired, listing elderly people as much younger and registering them as all manner of professions in order to justify their presence on his workforce.
Itzhak Stern recalled watching Nazi officials visit Oscar Schindler's offices. Quote, "Almost every day, from morning until evening, officials and other visitors came to the factory and made me nervous. Schindler used to keep pouring them vodka and joking with them. He used to tell them that he knew how to get work out of these Jews and that he wanted more brought in. That was how we managed to get in the families and relatives all the time and save them from deportation," end quote.
Oscar flattered his Nazi friends and plied them with gifts of gratitude, smuggled contraband goods. He and Amelia hosted SS officers at their home. All the while, his factory continued to produce enamelware and artillery for the army, so his requests for more Jewish workers were granted time and again.
This went on for about 3 years. Oscar Schindler hired hundreds of Jewish workers, saving them from the daily brutality of the Krakow ghetto.
Though he continued to profit from the injustices of the Nazi regime, the pro-German fervor that Oscar Schindler had been swept up in at the beginning of the war began to melt away. Every day, his loyalty to the Nazi party diminished.
Schindler said later that, quote, "Once I had experienced the first few months of German occupation, it became crystal clear to me that I, like millions of other ethnic Germans outside the Reich, had fallen for an extremely effective propaganda campaign. We had fallen under the sway of a gang of sadistic murderers and hypocritical swindlers who had fraudulently taken over the government of a great nation," end quote.
In March 1943, the Krakow ghetto was closed, and the Nazi forces shipped all its inhabitants to work camps. Over 2,000 Jewish prisoners were sent to die at the Auschwitz concentration camp, and the remaining population was sent to the closest Krakow camp, called Plaszow.
Schindler insisted that he still needed his workers in order to continue production for the Nazis, and he convinced his friends not to send them to Auschwitz.
Convincing his Nazi friends to let him hire Jewish factory workers was one thing, but this request put Schindler directly at odds with Ammon Goeth, commander of the Plaszow work camp.
Goeth was sadistic and cruel and delighted in killing. He was notorious for playing target practice with the camp's children, shooting at them with his high-powered rifle from the comfort of his deck.
Poldek Pfefferberg, a Jewish man who stayed at Plaszow and worked for Schindler, said that, quote, "When you saw Goeth, you saw death," end quote.
Schindler was not fully aware of the monstrosities being committed in Plaszow until later in 1943, when he visited the camp himself.
Mieczysław Pemper, an inmate at Plaszow who served as Goeth's personal clerk, recalled Schindler's first visit to the camp. In early 1943, Goeth had Pemper type up a letter to Schindler, telling him that he'd observed the Schindler's workers' daily march to the factory and disapproved of the fact that their escorts were unarmed.
Goeth told Schindler this was unacceptable. Quote, "I hereby inform you that the Jewish workers assigned to you will immediately cease to be allowed to come to your factory," end quote.
Schindler hastened to Plaszow to ply Goeth with cognac, cigars, schnapps, and friendly conversation. The two men hit it off, and Schindler managed to convince Goeth to allow his workers to continue working in the factory. Schindler would return to Plaszow a number of times. During these early visits, Schindler only met with Goeth at his house or in the officers' quarters.
In late 1943, Schindler received word that his friend and employee, Itzhak Stern, had fallen ill and couldn't come to work. Schindler went to Plaszow to bring Stern medicine.
This was the first time Oscar actually saw the conditions of the Jewish prisoners inside the camp.
Schindler left the camp a changed man, no longer simply content to shield his workers from the worst of Nazi control during the day while allowing them to return to Plaszow every night. He knew he had to save them.
Schindler was friends with a Nazi general who he convinced to call Goeth and order that Plaszow's population be put to work.
Schindler argued that these people were more valuable as workers producing supplies for the war effort than they were dead. And so Plaszow became a concentration camp instead of a death camp.
Ammon Goeth was pleased with the new development, as the camp's evolution afforded him a higher position in the military.
In fact, Goeth was so happy with Schindler that he approved a request to relocate roughly 1,000 Jewish workers to a living space closer to the factory.
These workers were removed from Plaszow and placed in a private, smaller work camp, allegedly for convenience and to save time transporting them back and forth every day.
Schindler found it much easier to smuggle medicine and supplies to his workers now that they were out from under Goeth's constant watch.
By the middle of 1944, over 1,000 workers lived in Schindler's camp. His fortune was dwindling, but he used what money he had to provide his people with whatever black market rations he could obtain.
At this time, the war was not going in Hitler's favor, and the Germans were being pushed out of Poland by the Allied and Russian forces. Oscar and Amelia Schindler had to cultivate relationships with SS officers and their wives and spent most of their money bribing contacts and buying rations for their employees.
In the fall of 1944, when it became clear that they were losing control of Poland, the Nazis ordered all Plaszow and its sub-camps, including Schindler's camp, to be emptied. The remaining Jewish population of Krakow was to be sent to their deaths at Auschwitz.
It fell to Schindler to save as many as he could.
We'll discuss the greatest part of Schindler's legacy when we come back.
Now back to the story. In 1944, Oscar Schindler learned that all of Krakow's Jewish prisoners, including the 1,000 that lived in the camp near his factory, were scheduled to be transported to nearby death camps.
the Nazis were growing ever more suspicious of Schindler. Ammann, Goethe, and German SS agents made frequent surprise visits to the factory to inspect Schindler's operation and terrorize his workers.
On one occasion, Goethe caught one of Schindler's men, a 20-year-old man named Isaac Pila, sleeping underneath a table on the factory floor. Goethe tested Schindler's loyalty by ordering him to kill Isaac instantly.
Schindler simply hit Isaac across the face and told Goethe that he needed him alive. Goethe let Isaac go, and the young man remained a part of Schindler's workforce until the end of the war.
Now that his workers were scheduled to be sent to their deaths, all of the skills and connections Oskar Schindler had cultivated as a spy and businessman were put to the test.
He could not allow the men and women he'd guarded for so long to be murdered, but he also couldn't afford to let the Nazis know what he was up to.
Schindler was walking a tightrope between his morality and his own interests, a stressful line between saving his Jewish workers and looking out for his own safety.
Schindler said of this time that, quote, "I no longer accepted anything uncritically and came to trust only my own judgment, my own humanity and sense of empathy. The suffering of the persecuted that I witnessed every day, as well as friends who thought the same way I did, helped me overcome the conflict within myself," end quote.
Schindler met with all his most powerful contacts, plying them with vodka and money, campaigning to move his factory out of Krakow and back to his homeland in Czechoslovakia.
There, he insisted he could continue to produce armaments for the Nazi forces. And, of course, he'd need his Jewish workers to run the new factory.
At first, nothing happened, and all the officials Schindler spoke to assured him that his campaign was a lost cause. Schindler left Krakow and traveled to Berlin, Germany, to plead his case to various Reich officials there.
His requests were not approved, and all hope seemed lost. But at last, someone caved to Schindler's requests and authorized him to move the munitions factory. He was given permission to move 700 Jewish men and 300 to 400 Jewish women to Brenjanets, Czechoslovakia.
As part of the deal, Schindler agreed to transport two boxcars worth of Ammann Goethe's personal belongings out of Krakow to Czechoslovakia to keep them out of the hands of invading Allied soldiers.
Here is where Schindler's famous list, immortalized in Steven Spielberg's 1993 film, comes into play. Although he did not write it himself, Schindler commissioned two of his Jewish secretaries to make a list of all 1,000 workers he was allowed to take with him to Czechoslovakia.
The names on that list were the Schindler Juden, or Schindler's Jews. Oskar referred to them privately as his children.
They included those who worked in Schindler's factory and whatever close relatives Oskar could persuade the SS officers to allow him to take.
Oskar also attempted to convince other Krakow business owners to do the same thing. The factory owners were all moving out of Poland to escape from the encroaching Western Front of the war, but they did not all share Schindler's concern for their employees.
Julius Madrich, a fellow factory owner and acquaintance of Schindler's, ignored Oskar's pleas to save his Jewish workers. Madrich said, quote, "Don't waste your breath, Oskar. It's a lost cause, and I won't invest another penny in it," end quote.
In the end, Schindler added 60 of Madrich's workers to his own list as company tailors.
By the time all of Schindler's workers were added, the number of people on the list tallied just over 1,000.
They were loaded onto a train and shipped off to Schindler's new Czech factory. The remaining 25,000 people in Plaszów were sent to their deaths in Auschwitz.
The move from Krakow to Brenjanets was rough. Only one group of 100 people made the journey in one go. The rest of Schindler's workers were pulled off their trains and detained at the Gross Rosen concentration camp, where they were tortured, beaten, and starved.
Schindler was forced to return to his SS contacts and bribe them with his dwindling funds to release his people.
This was a huge risk for Schindler because he could be exposed as being sympathetic to the Jewish prisoners, as this was a serious crime under Nazi rule. If he came under suspicion, Schindler could lose his rank, his money, he could even be jailed and killed.
But the bribes worked, and Schindler was able to pass off his concern as mere irritation. He insisted that the workers he already had were trained. It would take too much time and effort to educate a whole new workforce.
Schindler spoke later about the stress of that time. He said, quote, "No outsider can imagine how much work was involved, from the moment I made the decision to bring my Jews west with me to the moment I got them all, over 1,000 people, safely to the new location. The move seemed impossible and brought me to the brink of despair," end quote.
By November 1944, all of Schindler's Jewish workers, his Schindlerjuden, were remanded to the relative safety of the Brennenitz factory.
Schindler also convinced the Nazis to send him Jewish prisoners who had escaped from concentration camps and been recaptured. His workforce grew by another 100 people over the next several months, as escapees were sent across the border to Czechoslovakia to work for Schindler.
Though Schindler had an entire factory and 1,100 workers at his disposal, his plant at Brennenitz only produced one single wagon load of ammunition for the Nazis.
Oskar forged documents and production numbers to validate the existence of the factory. Instead, the workers spent time forging stamps and passports and stockpiling Nazi weapons.
Oskar and Amelia spent their time and fortune caring for the Schindlerjuden. Amelia cooked food and ministered to the sick, while Oskar depleted his remaining funds, buying black market rations for his workers and bribing the right people to keep them out of the death camps.
On one occasion, Schindler received a shipment of 100 sick Jewish men, diverted from their original destination and deposited at his factory inside a packed and frozen railway car.
The Brusau train station master called Schindler and told him there were two cars full of Jewish prisoners from Auschwitz sitting abandoned on his tracks, and asked if Schindler knew anything about them.
Thinking quickly, Schindler lied and said the train cars belonged to him. He'd been waiting on those workers for ages. He instructed the station master to send the prisoners to his factory immediately.
When no other camp or factory claimed them, Oskar and Amelia Schindler cracked the railway car open and rescued the men inside.
The men were emaciated beyond belief, wounded and dehydrated. Most of them were so starved that they could not stomach the normal rations distributed to the rest of Schindler's workers.
Amelia and Oskar used their connections to acquire rare semolina porridge, and Amelia cooked huge vats of food for the sick men, feeding and nursing them back to health over the next several days.
On May 9, 1945, Russian forces invaded Czechoslovakia and seized control of the country from the Nazis. Schindler dispatched a team of his workers, armed with rifles, to kill the local SS officer before the Russians arrived.
As a German factory owner and a known member of the Nazi Party, Oskar Schindler knew he was more likely to be shot by the Russians than captured.
He made sure everything was in order for when the Russians reached his factory and rescued his workers. Then Oskar, Amelia, and some of their office workers fled Czechoslovakia in Schindler's beloved Horsch car.
The Horsch was confiscated at the border, and the Schindlers were unable to smuggle out most of their little remaining money. They escaped Czechoslovakia with their lives and disappeared.
Oskar and Amelia resurfaced later in Regensburg, Germany, where Oskar provided the Allies with information on all the SS officers who had once been his valuable contacts. The Schindlers did not prosper in Germany, and Oskar was placed under investigation for some time as a possible war criminal.
Every powerful member of the Nazi Party was investigated after the war. Many claimed to have been coerced into committing war crimes, but few were genuinely innocent, as Schindler was.
Oskar Schindler was never put on trial for his actions during the Nazi occupation of Poland, but he did testify about his factory, his workers, and his spying during the trial of Amon Goeth. Goeth's defense actually called his friend Schindler as a witness, a strategy that backfired when Oskar told the court under oath about the horrors he'd seen at the Plaszow camp under Goeth's direction.
Though he did convince the Allied countries that he was not a villain, Schindler was destitute and struggled to live in post-war Germany. He applied for financial assistance from an American Jewish organization in 1948 and received enough funds to emigrate to Argentina in 1949.
The Schindlers tried farming in Argentina, but like most of Oscar's ventures, the business failed. Their marriage fell apart, and Oscar moved back to Germany in 1958 without Emilia.
Oscar tried and failed a few more times to start a successful business before eventually declaring total bankruptcy in 1963. After that, he was taken care of by several of the Schindlerjuden from his factory, who remembered the man who saved them and sought a way to show their gratitude.
The new Jewish state of Israel recognized Oscar Schindler's heroism posthumously. When Oscar died on October 9, 1974, he was buried in a place of honor on Mount Zion in Jerusalem. He was the only member of the Nazi Party ever to have that honor.
Those Schindler saved never forgot him. One of the Schindlerjuden, a man named Poldek Pfefferberg, fought for years to give Schindler the recognition he deserved.
Pfefferberg was just a young man when he was employed by Schindler at the factory, and the only member of his immediate family to survive the Holocaust. After the war, Pfefferberg left Europe and immigrated to Los Angeles.
Pfefferberg tried for years to convince Hollywood to tell Schindler's story, but nothing happened until 1980, when he met local novelist Thomas Keneally and presented him with an extensive amount of research on Oscar Schindler.
That meeting led to the hit book, Schindler's Ark, written by Keneally from Pfefferberg's extensive account.
The success of Schindler's Ark finally managed to catch Hollywood's eye, and in 1993, Steven Spielberg's Academy Award-winning film, Schindler's List, brought Schindler's story to the world.
Pfefferberg said later that he was so determined to tell Schindler's story because he wanted to pay him back in some way. He said, quote, "Schindler gave me my life, and I tried to give him immortality," end quote.
In 1993, perhaps influenced by the success of the film, Oscar Schindler was posthumously named as one of the Righteous Among the Nations, an award given to non-Jewish people who fought to save their fellow men from the terrors of the Nazis.
Oscar Schindler was a philanderer, a spy, a gambler, and a drinker. He willingly joined the Nazi Party and helped them invade both Poland and Czechoslovakia.
He was not a saint, but he was a hero. He saw the campaign of terror and genocide the Nazis waged against the Jewish population of Krakow, and he found a way to fight back.
Ifo Zwicker, a Jewish man who was familiar with Schindler from his pre-war days in Czechoslovakia and was one of the 1,200 people Oscar protected, said that he was surprised by Oscar's actions during World War II.
He said, quote, "I never would have considered him capable of all these wonderful deeds. Before the war, you know, everyone here called him a swindler," end quote.
Even Oscar Schindler himself recognized that he was a deeply flawed man. He said, quote, "I'm not a saint by any means. I'm a self-indulgent person with more faults than the average man who goes through life minding his own business," end quote.
Despite these flaws, Oscar Schindler stepped up when so many other decent men faltered.
Schindler told journalist Kurt Grossman in 1956 that his change of heart had been prompted by a sense of duty to the Jewish people he'd known as a boy in Czechoslovakia.
Schindler said, quote, "A powerful motivation for my actions was my sense of moral obligation to the many Jewish schoolmates and friends with whom I had enjoyed a wonderful boyhood," end quote.
Oscar Schindler spent all the money and connections he'd gained from the war in order to save 1,200 Jewish lives, and he will never be forgotten for it. Oscar Schindler proved that any man, no matter how lost, can be capable of enormous good.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Historical Figures.
A new episode releases every other Wednesday. You can listen to all of Parcast's shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory.
If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to help us is to leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen.
Thanks for listening.
We'll see you next time.
Historical Figures was created by Max Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Historical Figures is written by Colleen Bradley and stars Vanessa Richardson and Carter Roy.